It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to Catch Up with Louise Makshari. Happy Friday to you if you're listening on a Friday, if you're listening on a Saturday or a Sunday, or indeed a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Happy those days to you as well. I hope you're feeling good. I hope you've had a good week. If not, no worries. They can't all be good, as I'm always assuring you. This week has been, I'm not gonna lie, it hasn't been the best week. I was really sick earlier in the week, which you heard if you listened to the earlier episodes, and now my son is really sick. But I did manage to sandwich in a hair and nail appointment in between me being sick and him being sick, which is just like feels like divine timing, because I desperately needed to get my hair color done, and I had to reschedule already a few times. And I think if I hadn't managed to do it, you know, when you like, it's not important. Obviously, it's not important in the grand scheme of things. But you know, something happens, I think, if you're someone who colors your hair regularly and like, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. And then you wake up one day and you look in the mirror and you're like, if I don't get this sorted soon, my entire life is going to fall apart. It had gotten to that point. So I feel just very blessed that the end of my sickness and the beginning of Sam's sickness allowed for a gap in which I could get that very vital thing done. But I mean, look, it happens. C'est la vie, I think, from what I hear. In the meetings that I did manage to make this week, everybody's sick at the moment. So if you're sick, my friends, take care of yourselves. I hope you are being cared for and loved and adored as you deserve. Just a little reminder, if you want to join us over on the Patreon, there is a new mailbag episode going up today. We do an extra episode every second week on the Patreon, and it's also just a great way to support the podcast. You guys, it means so much to me when you do. You hear me say it all the time, but honestly, in order for me to keep doing it, particularly, I guess, at the rate at which I've decided to do it at this stage, it is crucial, and it means so much to me. So thank you to everyone who has joined up over there. Other than that, not a whole lot to say at the start of this, except for the fact that I am presenting a panel, or leading a panel, having a panel, joining a panel. No, I'm heading up the panel of people at tomorrow evening at Culture Club in Collins Barracks, which is organized by Mother. This event, I went last year, it was so much fun. I wasn't involved last year. I just was someone who bought a ticket and went, and I had a brilliant time. It is so much fun. There's so much going on, so much dancing, so much crack. PJ Kirby's doing a gaily. He's going to teach everybody how to do the Walls of Limerick and stuff like that. Elaine May is getting a group of Irish musicians together for a set that I'm sure will be fantastic, because she did it last year and it was absolutely incredible. There's chat, there's drag performances. House of Wig, which I was only kind of singing its praises a few weeks ago, is going to be there. And I'm, as I said, going to be doing a panel where I'll be joined by three wonderful people. James Kavanagh is one of them, who, you know, I absolutely adore. I'm also going to be joined by drag queen Victoria's Secret and one of the co-founders of Honeypot, which is a queer night for women in Dublin. And we're going to be talking about club nights, clubs, queer spaces, why all of that stuff is really important, how it feeds into our social development. I'm going to get James to tell some old war stories from actual war, the club night, which I know he was a true icon of. He's also been involved in so many other special nights, so I'm really looking forward to hearing that. I'm looking forward to hearing from Victoria about the drag scene and, you know, how easy slash hard it is to carve out a space these days. And then also, I think it's going to be really, really interesting to hear about how people, you know, the kind of next generation are managing to work within the current licensing laws, which obviously we discussed earlier in the week and actually comes up in today's interview as well. So I think it's going to be really fun. That's at 7:30. It's in Tegin. If you want to come and see that, please do. And then we can all go have an absolute bop to my guest this week, who is Saoirse. Saoirse is a globally renowned DJ. She's a producer. She is the boss of her own record label, Trust. She's the founder of East London's first queer electronic music festival, Body Movements, which you'll hear us chat about. And this weekend, she's the headliner of Mother's Culture Club at Collins Barracks. As the name might suggest, I mean, you wouldn't ever predict, would you, that a person named Saoirse would be Irish? But of course, she is. She's from Dublin, and you'll get to hear in this chat all about her growing up in Dublin, which I super, like, I really enjoyed hearing what her childhood was like since. Super interesting how she got into music, how she took her career to the next level. She's really fascinating. And I really enjoyed talking to her, and I hope you really enjoy listening to it. Stick around at the end. I do have one or two recommendations. I also just have some feelings to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about Big Brother, and I want to talk just a little bit about Love is Blind as well. So I'll talk to you in a little bit. Saoirse, it is a pleasure to speak to you. I am so looking forward to, as I was just saying, so looking forward to your set at Culture Club on Saturday in Collins Barracks. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, really good. I mean, quite nervous, but like very honoured, I would say. And I think it's just kind of just the amalgamation of it both being in that location and it being kind of, you know, such a, I guess, a big celebration of queer culture as well in Ireland. Mm. It's kind of like, you know, embodying two of the most important things to me. So, yeah. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I was at it last year, and I remember standing in a tent, and there were like almost naked go-go dancers, and we were like, we're here in Collins Barracks, surrounded by like queer go-go dancers. Like, my God, this country has come so far.
Exactly. It's kind of I'm sure plenty of the old historical figures would be turning their graves, but who knows? Well. Maybe they'd be foreign, you know?
Well, this is it. I'm sure they would have progressed with the rest of us, hopefully, anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
But come here, we've loads to talk about, but I suppose let's start at the very beginning. You're from Dublin. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Dublin. What was your life like?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it was just me and my ma. Mm-hmm. And we kind of lived in a few different places, but I do feel like now at this stage, Kevin Street, the kind of Ivy building flats, would call home, even though I was kind of a little bit older when I moved there. I can't remember exactly, but I think maybe 11, 12, something like that. But like, that's where I feel like is home to me, you know? Mm. A proper townie. And I grew up in quite a alternative household. You know, it was very, very musical. My mother played quite a few instruments. A lot of her friends were also, we were in kind of various different drumming bands, and there was just like a lot, you know, my ma was a trad musician as well, so spent a lot of time around trad music every Sunday, kind of in Temple Bar and stuff like that. I remember doing busking with my ma. Like, yeah, it was kind of a very like different, I would say, upbringing to a lot of people that I went to school with. And she was also very active in, like, you know, political activism as well. So, you know, from as long as I can remember, I was kind of on marches, basically against, you know, the system, basically, you know. It was definitely like interesting to say the least, but yeah. You know, I think what's funny is when I was growing up that way, I was quite like, when you grow up in that kind of environment, you know, where your mother and her friends are constantly on marches, and you know, they're doing like a lot of protesting, when you're just a kid, like you're bored of that, you know what I mean? You're kind of like, because you don't really know any better, like when I was very, very young, and I was kind of like, oh, I don't want to do this, I want to do something else, you know what I mean? But what's quite funny is a lot of that, I guess, you know, political direction has definitely stayed with me, and I've found it myself so much more engaged now as I, you know, got older. And I think that was just due to the kind of way I was brought up. I think it was a huge part of that to play, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I have two children and they've been to a lot of marches, and probably not as many as your mom was. Your mom sounds like she was really hard at it. But obviously with what's going on in Gaza and everything, we've been out marching a lot. And my older son is just like, has no interest now. Like, I can't drag him and there's no point in dragging him, so I don't. But my four-year-old is absolutely mad for it, like well up for it. And I find myself wondering, like, who are these guys going to be? Like, is this going to be stuff that they remember? Will it stand to them? Because they are in school. Like, I was commiserating with one of my son's friend's moms the other day, because she was like, oh, I had a can of Coke in the house the other day and Robin went mental at me because, you know, Coke is, we're boycotting Coke. And like, you know, they're so engaged that like, I do believe it'll, you know, put them in good stead. So it's great to hear you say that you feel like it really impacted your political views as
definitely
you grew up.
Did. I mean, when it comes to stuff like that, like, I was not allowed to drink Coke. Mm. I was not allowed to wear Nike. I was not allowed to go to McDonald's because of, you know, Nestle. Like, there was all these like really, I guess, multinational companies that were doing atrocious things in other parts of the world. Mm. They were banned, you know. So I think my ma's, she was a lot more hardline than it than when I was growing up. I think she's had to soften a bit because, you know, years and years of that kind of that work is really wears you down. Do you know what I mean? I mean, she's for Amnesty now, so still a part of her life and everything, like the campaigning side, but it not as, you know, it was more nearly like anarchy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Back then. So I've always had that kind of like distrust of police and just like a lot of governments and so forth. It's been kind of, you know, it's a lot of my other parts of my family as well. It's just I've been quite active in politically as well. So it's kind of been a big part of my upbringing, and it's certainly stayed with me as I've kind of moved into an adult. So I'm sure your kids will, you know, remember it eventually, you know.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll hope.
Yeah. But obviously that musical kind of surroundings for you must have played a part as well in where you went on with your career. What are your earliest, are presumably your earliest memories of music?
Yeah, I think my earliest memories of music are kind of when there was a lot of like, I guess like instrumental live music. Mm. I also played a lot of instruments. Well, I tried my hand at them. I think the one that I stuck with the longest was the drums. I had like a drum kit and I really, you know, spent a long time trying to be a drummer. And then I also played the djembe and a few other kind of percussive instruments. But I also, you know, my mother and her friends, they used to, you know, that kind of world as well was very involved in throwing like parties, you know. Mm. So there was a lot of kind of free parties as well that I remember as a youngster being at. And they were very community based kind of things. Like, a lot of people would be there and they'd have their kids there or whatever. But, you know, it was, like I said, a very kind of alternative upbringing. But essentially they were raves, you know. Mm. And I was at these raves from a very young age. So that kind of like I literally think I must have been about maybe 7 or 8 or so when I was listening to stuff like Left Field and Orbital.
Wow.
And, you know. Like, and I remember going into Tower Records really, really young and just like standing there for hours, just, you know, you used to have you'd be able to listen to what the latest album was out, whatever. And I would literally just stand there, listen to it for like a couple of hours, all these like electronica albums and stuff. So like that electronic music was, from as far as I can remember, kind of in me. And I don't know whether it was because of what was there, or because I was drawn to it. Like, it's kind of something that I just, you know, was absolutely drawn to. But I definitely know that it was like an obsession from a very, very young age. Mm. And it's stuck.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something about in you as well. Like it's, it takes more than just being surrounded by something to feel so connected to it. And
yeah.
So when did you start actually DJing? Where did you pick up your first gigs?
Well, so when I was like 14 or so, I hung around with a lot of lads that were like a few years older than me. And, you know, they, like quite a few of them had decks, and we all used to go to their house and like watch them mix. And I remember just always being like, I want to do this. Like this, it was like tunnel vision. I was like, this is like my goal in life, like just to get a set of decks.
Okay.
And, but they were so expensive. Like there was just no way you could, buy them. And then a friend of mine ended up wanting to sell his, and we got them for like a really, really good price and so like a little bit more affordable. So at age 14, I got my first set of Numark belt drives, and I bought two records. One was a hard house record, Paul Glasby Kick it was called, and another was like a hip hop record by Nelly. I think it might have been like whatever it was something like, wasn't Hot in Here, it was before that, but it was just, it was obviously not mixable with hard house. But I spent months trying to like try and work it out, you know, because I had a clue. I actually like even remember I didn't even have speaker or maybe an amp or something at that point. So I used to be, you know, you could kind of listen to like the deck, like you can nearly like hear some sort of like sound coming out of it, you know. So so like I started just learning how to mix then, and then I started recording CDs or tapes first and then CDs, and I used to actually like go around and sell the CDs to mates, mix CDs and stuff, and I learned how to mix on these decks. And then I think maybe when I was about 17, I think it was for my 18th, I did a little party in a pub just off Thomas Street, and we brought the decks down and stuff, and like I had a little set there, like a load of friends or whatever. And then I had my first gig in the Parnell Mooney. I might have put on the gig myself, to be honest.
Wow. I'm really impressed by your initiative. It's very impressive.
Well, there was no getting gigs for a female in Dublin at that point, you know.
I was going to ask you, how did even your friends respond to you DJing as a teenage girl?
I mean, I feel like I was always one of the lads, like, so I don't, what when it really became harder was, it wasn't with my friends. They were always like, let's go, you know, playing my mixes all the time back at parties and blah, blah, blah.
That's cool.
But for sure, they were always really behind it and came to every single gig that I did do for the next few years.
Love it.
But it was when I actually start getting some gigs, that's when it became, that's when I experienced the real, like, you know, misogyny of the music industry. There used to be forums on that we'd be on. I think it was called Dance Music Ireland or something like that. And I'd be on it all day, every day. Like, and we'd just be talking about tunes, talking about a set we saw, talking about, like, there'd be about, like, you know, 100 people at any one time. And it was a real kind of community. And that's actually how I met a lot of my friends. But I remember being slated on there, you know, by certain people just being like, she couldn't mix cement and la, la, la. And, you know, they would come for you so bad. And then you had to see these people out at the parties. And I mean, they were right. I couldn't mix them, but nobody could really. Like, you know, the only people that were really, really good at mixing at that point were people who've been playing on Technics 1210s for years. Like, I only started playing on Technics when I was getting gigs out, and they were very different to the decks I had. So I was struggling a lot. It was definitely like, I think I knew one other female DJ personally. Kira Glynn, Bunny was her DJ name at the time, and we became really good friends. But like, actually, like on a personal level, I only knew of maybe two or three other female DJs in Ireland that were like across the country, and that was it.
And was there anyone outside of Ireland, like, who were you looking up to?
I mean, like, there was people, like, I was into hard house and trance and stuff, so at that age, you know, 17 16 17 18, so people like Lisa Lashes, Rachel Auburn, Lisa Pinup, you know, they were the kind of the women, like, There was Animac, but like that came later.
Yeah.
And also like the music, I was into really hard, fast stuff back then.
Yeah.
And like I was playing more, I guess, housey stuff, whatever.
Yeah.
So there was women out there and you'd know them by, but you could count them on your one hand.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's obviously hugely different now, but.
So how did you kind of carve out the path for yourself then? Because it's not like it was well trodden. You presumably had to figure it out for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing for me was I was playing trance and hard house and I was a real trance geek. And then I went to live in Ibiza. I did some seasons there when I was 18 and I discovered house music. And in Dublin at that point, like we used to slag off house music because the house music that I knew from Dublin wasn't the stuff that I heard when I went out there, you know, like it was stuff you'd hear in Spirit and in all these kind of a lot more accessible commercial clubs, you know?
Yeah.
And I was also working in Abbey Discs at the time. And that was one of the, like, the, you know, the pinnacle, like, record stores in the country.
Yeah.
And even there, like, a lot of the house music that I heard in there was still very, it was a bit more commercial, you know?
Mm.
And then when I went to Ibiza and I started going to places like Space and DC10 and, you know, Zuli and all these other parties where I heard like proper house music and minimal and stuff like that, like everything just changed for me. And I realized like this music was the music that I really absolutely adored. And so I kind of after a year or so like found myself playing more and more of that stuff, and then came away from trance. You know, I still have a lot of love and respect for trance and I throw in quite a bit of it every now and again, but it wasn't the road for me. Do you know what I mean? So the hardest thing was coming back to Dublin, because I'd had quite a lot of really big trance gigs. Like I played on the same lineup as like people like Tiesto and I think like Lisa Lashes and like Armin van Buuren and all this, and I kind of made a little name for myself in that world. But then I just didn't want to be in that world anymore, really. And also, like, the crowds were very different at trance shows and then at, like, parties with, like, house music and techno and stuff. And then trying to get, I tell you now, like, trying to get into the house, the more kind of house, cool, undergroundy parties from being a trance DJ was no. Like, there people were like, absolutely not. You're a trans DJ. Get back in your box. Like, nobody wants you here. Do you know what I mean? It was really, really like that. And, you know, it was very clicky.
Yeah.
And I had to just send mixes and mixes and mixes to people until eventually someone who became a really close friend of mine, but, you know, tragically passed away a few years ago, Al Keegan, who was, you know, a really great promoter in Dublin. Gave me my first gig in that world and then continued to, you know, to book me. And then having the nod from him and his parties, I think, really helped me then get other shows. But realistically, there was still a ceiling of you're a local DJ and, you know, we know you, we've known you since forever. And it just really felt like I wouldn't ever, you know, I kind of had hit this real ceiling in Dublin, and that as well as being a woman, as well as having that kind of history of trance and promoters not taking me seriously. And then with the club scene in Ireland being very, you know, on this kind of ground of like a lot of places closing down, not really good spaces anymore. It was all kind of like after party warehouse parties and stuff like that. It just was really clear to me that like there wasn't really much opportunity there, you know. And when I went to London and I went to Fabric for the first time, and I was at the birthday there, and the birthday goes on for like 48 hours pretty much, and it was bloody like sometime in the afternoon on Sunday, and we'd been there since Saturday night, and I was like, you know, like clubs in Ireland close at 2 a.m at that point, you know what I mean? I remember just being like, I need to move here. there's no question in my mind, like this is where I need to be. And that was 15 years ago now, so I up and left about 6 months later, and then that was and the funny thing is that like I just felt like there was nobody was you know, I'd been DJing forever at that point. This was when I was like 23, 24 maybe. And I'd been DJing for so many years. Everyone knows each other in the scene in Ireland and Dublin. And I still just wasn't getting that, like, I felt like that support, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just like, I mean, maybe I wasn't good enough, but also I just felt like it's a thing.
I'm pretty sure you were good enough, like, given everything that you've done since then.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like it's just, it was a problem. I think it's gotten much better now, but it was a problem in Ireland where, like, you know, there wasn't enough focus on at the big shows on local community, like, acts or, like, local artists, like, as in propping up, like, people who were, like, good enough to do the job. Instead, everyone's all about getting international DJs from. And I think that's a big part of the reason why the scene really, like, found it really hard to actually sustain, because it was too expensive to do that, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I see, like, artists being really, like, put on a pedestal of, like, you know, we're behind you from promoters now, Irish artists. And I really think that's the way to go. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I had to get,
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think what you said there is true for so many Irish industries, that, like, you know, you're not taken seriously until you go somewhere else, and then you do well somewhere else. And then all of a sudden, like, I mean, I've seen that in media so much over, I've been in media for 20 years, like, and I've seen it so much. You go off, you do anything with the BBC or Channel 4, and then you come home and you're, like, lauded as royalty. But, you know, those people generally have been rejected in Ireland before they ever get, you know, and the only way to be taken seriously is to almost to go away and come back. And
I don't understand it, really. You know, it's weird because Irish people are so, like, kind of, you know, patriotic in a sense.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When it comes to, like, anything like sport or whatever.
Mm.
But when, you know, so you would think that, like, that kind of, I guess, like, that attitude would also be within the music industry, but it just wasn't. And you look at people like Sunil Sharp, you know, who's obviously doing so much.
Mm.
But Sunil was on the scene a lot longer than I was.
Yeah.
And only in the last, I really also believe that, like, you know, Sunil was, he would get booked everywhere, but he was always kind of getting booked as support acts a lot of time for these really big shows.
Mm.
And he's one of the best DJs ever.
Mm.
And, you know, when he started getting booked a lot, then, you know, Berghain and all sorts all around the world, I feel like he got a lot more attention in his own country. And I just think that, like, it does happen quite often.
Yeah.
And I know Annie's agreed with me on this as well. Mm. And, like, yeah, it's just kind of, I do see a change now, but it's definitely something that it's not a great way. Like, I think what I see from traveling the world is the places that have the best scenes are the ones who have a really, really, like, active, like, local community, like, residents, you know, people really get behind it, the people that, the promoters and the clubs that really support their local talent.
Yeah,
they're the parties that everyone wants to go and play.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you see it in places like Berlin, Amsterdam, and in New York or whatever. Like, there's a lot of people there who are famous in their own right, because they've had the support of people in their own cities, you know?
Which makes sense, because you're building a culture, you're building your own culture within your city, within your country. You're not importing it from somewhere else.
Exactly.
So that makes total sense to me. And I think you're right. Like, I think things have improved. I did a new music show on 2FM for 8 years. And even in the space of those 8 years, like, the change in the Irish music industry was massive. Like, I mean, just even in terms of the diversity of what was being produced, like, when I first started working in radio 20 years ago, it was mainly just, like, guys with guitars. And now, obviously, it's so different. There's so many different people doing such cool things. And people are taken a lot more seriously now, as you say, and are platformed in their own right, which, thank God, because, as you say, we are so patriotic in every other area. And also, we're so talented, given the size of this island.
Yeah,
like, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Natural creative poets, basically, you know?
And
I think that, like, because of Ireland's history, there's so much rawness in, like, our blood that can really, you know, amount to really incredible, like, creativity, especially when it comes to music. So there's absolutely no reason for people to be looking elsewhere for the talent when it's right there in front of you, you know.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Well, it's an awful shame that you had to leave Ireland to take the next steps and to move up the ladder, as it were. But you really did move up that ladder, and you've done such incredible things, you know, over the course of the last 15 years since you left Ireland. One of the coolest things that, well, one, no, I won't decide what's the coolest things that you've done, but one of my favorite things that you've done is co-found Body Movements, which is, if for anybody who doesn't know, it's a London-based queer electronic music festival. Jesus. So you started that in 2021, and I have yet to go, but I'm dying to go. And everyone I know who's been just says it's the best time ever. So what motivated you to do that in the first place?
So it was actually 2019.
We
didn't do our first one until the 2021 because of COVID. But 2019, it was supposed to launch. Mm. What it was like, I was playing a lot of queer events around the country, around Europe, and really like noticing that, firstly, they were some of the best parties I was playing at, just because of the kind of community feel. They were very DIY. They were very about, you know, they were about the music, about it, you know. There was just kind of a different feeling than, you know, your regular parties that I was playing at that were more like heteronormative or whatever. Mm. And then also the other thing I was really noticing was the talent of the residents, you know, the people that kind of belong to those collectives were some of the best DJs that I had seen in years. And I was really, you know, really thinking about how much kind of like undiscovered talent there was as well within the kind of queer community, and how little like promoters of big festivals especially were doing in order to like diversify their, you know, their kind of queer talent on their lineups, whatever. It's not something that people were looking at enough, certainly not, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. Mm. So I just like, I think one day I just had an idea of like, what if like everyone just like did something together, like collaborated together. It was very much just like, just ideas at the time. And I had like, my first thought was like, what if we got all the collectives to do like kind of nearly like back to backs of, you know, their parties together. And it was, you know, kind of thinking of ideas. And I approached a friend of mine who already had like experience in running festivals, and I'd worked with him for a long time, Simon. And he was like, thought, you know, hey, this is a great idea. I'm also working with someone who also has the idea of doing a queer festival and is looking for like, you know, to work with someone on it. And we kind of just put our ideas together. And then it was very much like, right, well, should we do this?
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, fuck.
You know, now we have to do this. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we kind of put the idea out to a lot of people, a lot of the kind of collectives, like, first, you know, what do you think about this? Like, do you think it could work? And everyone seemed really behind it. You know, it was always going to be about the mission, I guess, was always about like platforming queer talent. So like music discovery, like giving like, I guess, like more spotlight to people. You know, a lot of these events have always been kind of confined to like, you know, dark spaces where not many people know about and whatnot. But, you know, this was about like making it like a bit more accessible, but like, you know, kind of showing the festival world and what a queer, you know, event really is, and the kind of talent that exists within that community. Mm. And it was, you know, we always had the thought of like, we never wanted to be about big headliners. We wanted it to very much be majority kind of local talent, or at the very least like half and half and everything. And that very much was how it began, and you know, we've tried to stay true to that. I mean, it's very difficult in this kind of market when there's so much competition, and yeah. You know, you do sometimes need those names that are going to, you know, sell tickets and whatnot. But yeah, it came together, and then after the first one, you know, I mean, it was bloody stressful. Like, you're working with over 120 artists, I think, 30 something collectives, and everyone has their own needs and their own kind of like
priorities.
You're dealing with so many different needs of different subcultures, and you know, obviously, like, you have to be very careful, and not careful, but I think caring, I think, is like the right word, with so many people with different vulnerabilities, because essentially, like, you're working with people, a lot of people who've been through a lot of trauma because of their queerness, you know, and so, you know, just having to like put in a huge amount of duty of care, which you wouldn't see as much in, you know, your kind of regular events or whatever. Yeah. So that's definitely the biggest struggle. And that's probably what we invest the most in terms of like welfare and security, and, you know, just kind of like actually like spending time like with consultants and everything to find out like what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, how do we make it better, kind of thing. Yeah. That's and then we did it, and it was amazing. It was like, we were like, wow, this is actually really special, and it felt more like way bigger than, you know, we thought it would be, in terms of actually like more of an important kind of community event. And we kind of see ourselves more now as like, we're facilitators of this thing. All of the collectives who've, you know, done all this kind of work to build their communities and everything, like, they come, and they obviously, like, you know, they're the ones who are performing. They're the ones who are kind of, I guess, the highlight, you know what I mean? Mm. And we're kind of facilitating in the background to make it happen, I guess.
So I'm interested to hear, because obviously Culture Club is a queer event, and it's great fun and I love it, but it will be over early, and everything is over early in Dublin still. And I'm interested to hear what your take is on the Dublin scene currently.
I mean, the funny thing is, you know, it will be over early. I mean, when it comes to day events, I think it's the same in London. We have to close our festival at 10 o'clock as well. But there's always somewhere to go afterwards. Yeah. I think that's the big difference. It's so beyond, like, at this point, I actually don't understand the reasoning, like, as to why. If to me, it just feels very simple. Like, it would be less stress on the streets of Dublin and less resource needed to, you know, have people dripping out of a club from 2 till 6 a.m. than thousands of people coming out at the same time.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why that's just, you know, like, living in London, you know, you have such a huge nightlife, but I never ever see like huge issues because of like, you know, late exit time or whatever. Mm. And so I do think it's really sad that like Ireland doesn't have the opportunity to really thrive as a cultural hotspot in terms of, you know, nightclubs and dance music, because there's so, it's in their blood. Like, when you're growing up, you're either like a rocker or you're into raves. Like, there's no, like, you know what I mean? Or you're really sporty or whatever. Yeah. Like, there's kind of the only two things to do. And I think that, like, dance music in Ireland is so much more prevalent than any other country that I know, from a very early age.
Yeah.
So, like, it's a huge thing, you know, and always has been. So it's like, it's so innate to Irish people, but like, still have some of the most ridiculous like licensing laws in whole Europe, you know. Yeah.
And I mean, they have the legislation now, you know, they've said that they're going to change it, but it's been, they keep kicking the can down the road. We actually just talked about it. This podcast has a news episode every week as well. And we just talked about it in the news episode because it was supposed to be, well, it's been supposed to be in about five times, but the last time it was supposed to be in, it was supposed to be in before Christmas. And then it was supposed to be in before this summer. And now they're saying that's not going to happen. And it just, it's not a priority, obviously, even though it has such a huge impact on people's lives. And obviously, you know, we've had venue after venue closing here because it's just not financially viable to only be open a few hours a night, you know, a couple of nights a week. So yeah, it is frustrating. It's very frustrating. I hope though, once it eventually comes in, we will see a thriving scene.
1,000,000%, and maybe people will come back, you know, because I read a ridiculous statistic a while back that said, I mean, I might be wrong on this, but it was something like 40% of people under 21 leave Ireland, which is, that's, you know, a big part of that is because there's this limit of things that, like, you know, you can do in Ireland that you can do elsewhere that you can't do in Ireland. You know what I mean? Yeah. Obviously a big part of that is jobs and stuff as well. But I do think that, like, that culture in the arts is a huge part why people leave Ireland. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It all matters.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, like, I have absolutely no doubt that if and when that it does happen, that, like, Ireland will become an absolutely essential spot for raves. Like, because it's so, like, it's already so popular. So I can only imagine when it has the opportunity to, you know, do that as well. You know what I mean? Yeah. So really, the night doesn't get going until then.
Yeah.
Until 2:00. You know.
Well, we are going to have loads of fun on Saturday in Collins Barracks. I saw you're having a little party in the afternoon as well.
That's right. So we're doing a little shindig down at Love Tempo. Mm. I'm going to be playing some music. We have someone coming to do tooth gems. And we also have little tattoos and everything. And it'll be just a bit of crack, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like great fun. The margarita menu, by the way, if you have not sampled in Love Tempo, this is for everybody who's listening, and you, is stunning. There's an entire mezcal section. It's like it was made for me.
Oh, now you're talking my language.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're going to have a ball. Have a ball. Well, Saoirse, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. Hopefully the next time we speak, our licensing laws will be changed. I'll be bopping up the front at your gig on Saturday.
Brilliant. Okay. You look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Now, as discussed, you can go and see Saoirse tomorrow if you're listening on Friday at Culture Club in Collins Barracks as part of Mother's event there. It's going to be so good. I am so, so looking forward to it. If you're there, I shall see you. Do come and say hi if you want to, but you don't have to, obviously. Do whatever you like, my friends. Now, I said I wanted... So while I was sick, I thought, what can I watch that like requires no brain activity whatsoever? And I chose Love is Blind, and I had it on in the background. And I hadn't watched, like, I think there's been 6 seasons of it, and I hadn't watched since maybe season 1. I think maybe I've only watched 1 season of it previously. And my God, it is a completely insane show. Like, it's insane. Like, I can't believe that anybody would go on it. I can't believe the way they talk about each other and the way they talk about their lives. For anybody who hasn't seen it, the premise is, I'm sure you know the premise, but a load of women and a load of men, it's extremely straight, go into a place where there are all these rooms, which they call pods, and they speak to each other through a wall, so they can't see each other at all. And then, having not seen each other, the basis on which to move forward and meet each other is that they have to propose, which is insane. And then they spend some time together, and then they decide whether they want to get married. And some of them decide that they don't want to get married before they get to their wedding day, air quotes. But some of them wait all the way until they're at the altar and then say yay or nay. And it is bananas. It's bananas. It's so crazy. But I particularly wanted to talk about one relationship, which was so toxic and made me feel so sad. And that was the relationship between Chelsea and Jimmy. If you haven't seen it, feel free to just skip forward a couple of minutes. If you have, I just have to say this to someone. Chelsea made me so sad, and Jimmy made me so sad. Like, clearly they should not be together. Like, that is so clear. But mainly because she is so insecure and so kind of damaged, I would say, that she wanted to like pick fights and find problems all the time where there weren't problems. And I just think that's so sad, because she mentioned a few times that she'd had previous relationships which had really, you know, damaged her ability to trust people in relationships. And you, I felt like you could really see that coming through. And I feel like, you know, if you were her friend, you would only be hearing her perspective on things, and you would probably think, oh yeah, that is dodgy what he did, or he shouldn't have done that, or he shouldn't have done X, Y, or Z. But when you, when it's all there on TV in black and white, you can kind of see that actually he's just being fine. Like, he's, you know, maybe he wasn't giving her as much affection as she wanted, but like, he was being fine. But she was so, she couldn't believe that he could like her, I think what was going on. So she was looking for problems and making up problems that weren't there. And it just was so sad. But like, she was gaslighting him constantly. It was a crazy show. Crazy, crazy, crazy. And then, I'm not going to lie, I was shocked when Clay said no at the altar with AD. Truly shocked. Like, why would you wait until you get to the friggin' altar? Like, if I was her, that's what I would have been pissed off about. I would have been like, grant you don't want to marry me after a few weeks. Like, that's reasonable. But like, you could have done it before I put on the wedding dress. I don't know. The whole program is insane. Then I also just wanted to touch very briefly on Celebrity Big Brother, because obviously we talked about it during the Celebs episode this week. But the really vicious stuff hadn't happened with Jedward yet. And my God, Louis is really nasty, isn't he? Like, he's a nasty piece of work. And it's a real shame for someone who's so successful to still be kind of so negative about people. Still, it's a very entertaining program. I'm disappointed in Ek and Sue. People, like, after Love Island, everybody talked about her so highly. I kind of assumed she'd be sound and cool, but she is not coming across that way. Interested to hear your thoughts. Anyway, please do share them with me. I would love to hear what you're thinking. I'm afraid those are the main things that I watched over the course of the last week, so I don't have a lot of recommendations. And I haven't started a new book. I read a book, which will be the subject of next week's interview. So that took up most of my time. And that is Mark Meegan's book, which I really, really enjoyed. I picked it up kind of not intending to read much of it at that time. And I ended up reading like three quarters of it in one go. It's really well written, like a really easy book to get into, and has a lot of really good stuff in it. It's called This Is Not a Self-Help Book. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. So if you're planning on reading it, if you want to read it before next Friday, you might get a lot out of it. But honestly, you do not have to have read it before hearing the chat at all. So there you go. That's what I've kind of been up to. That's what I've been watching. That's what I've been reading. Yeah, that's kind of listening to Ariana Grande's new album. Those are my main activities. So I'm going to let you go now. I'm going to go check on Sam because he's in the other room, miserable. And I will talk to you, my friends, on Monday. I hope you have a good one. Obviously, they can't all be good. Don't worry about it if it's not. Just put one foot in front of the other. And I will chat to you again on Monday. Thank you to Acast for having me on the network. Thank you so much to my contributors this week. And I will talk to you soon.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.